I'll move back with you. How's that? Because I don't like talking to empty benches. Got a couple things on my mind. One is Labor Day, just a little bit on that. Labor Day is a holiday especially for people who work, not for people who own businesses or people who are independently wealthy and don't go to work every day. This is for people who get up every morning, whether they feel like it or not, and go out and do what needs to be done. They milk their cows, they feed their horses, and nobody even notices because it's just like a sound system. If it works right, nobody even notices. So this is a day set aside to recognize those important people that just grind along and do things. You know, there's Cal Ripken, who's the Iron Man of baseball, because he didn't miss a game for how many years? 15 or 20 years, does anyone know? Yeah, I think, you know, there are people in this audience who didn't miss milking their cows for more than 15 years in a row, twice a day. He didn't play twice a day. So we have iron men and iron women to recognize on this day. I read in this book recently, it's a book by Brené Brown, and it's called The Gifts of Imperfection. And there's some really good advice in here for me, because I have this thing about getting everything just right, and if it's not perfect, I get all torqued and twisted and out of shape. You know, and it's, you know, because it has to be just right, you know, and I get upset and I carry on. And she talks about that in this book. And she talks about relationships in here. And what the part I want to point out a little bit to sort of inform where I'm going with my stories is she talks about love. And she says, love is uncertain between people and it is not easily measured. And think about that a while. You know, how much do you love me more than, you know, more than that one or this one, you know, and what's my order and everything. You know how it is. People want to get everything in order and they want to know whose dad is the strongest and who loves me the most and all that sort of stuff. Well, it's not easy unless you're in fifth grade. Then, of course, everything's easy. Yeah. And she also says that love always comes with a sense of belonging. It's almost never separated. It's almost always talked about, especially in relation. Well, in relationship. How are you going to be in relationship without belonging to somebody? Makes sense, sort of. And she says it's a basic urge of human beings to be part of something greater than themselves. And the last thing that I want to point out that she brings out in this book is that love is more practically thought of as an action rather than a feeling or an emotion when you're trying to figure out how to work through and create a certain kind of relationship. She says that thinking of it as an action brings with that accountability and responsibility. And it gave me something to think about, because that's not really the American way with love, I don't think. It's really, the emphasis is more on the emotion. So I want to talk today a little bit about, I have a story that dwells on these things, these ideas a little bit. And this story is about my Aunt Ida. My Aunt Ida is younger than my mom, a couple years. And one of my earliest memories of Aunt Ida, I was probably 3 years old, and she was of the aunts. She was a little darker. She saw that the glass was half empty, and she was concerned about all the rules and making sure everyone that followed just right, because, you know, you don't want to, you just want to avoid being smitten by God. And I remember her, you know, and she was a friendly enough, you know, aunt, but not as demonstrative as some of the others. And didn't laugh as much or as loud. But I do remember her before she was married. And I remember her It must have been a Sunday evening. We'd been back to visit, and we were at my grandpa's house and grandma's, and Ida had gussied herself all up. She'd gotten a really nice dress on and everything. And I remember seeing coming in the back door of the house, and there's kind of a, you know, kind of open window, so I could see him. I saw Denny Gingrich, and he had on a bright green shirt. I don't see a green quite like that in the audience. Almost like your sweater over there. But a little bit brighter, kind of what we'd call poison green. And it was just, you know, you could not avoid that. It was green and it was in your face. And I, 3 years old, I could tell something really important was going on. There was electricity in that house and they didn't even have wires coming into it. And he was there to pick up Aunt Ida and take her to the singing. And I just remember, I knew this was important. And anyway, they went off to the singing, and wouldn't you know, they went steady after a while, we heard. And then we got an invitation to a wedding. And this was after we'd moved to, my parents and I had moved to New Glarus, Wisconsin, to a new community. But we were not going to miss that wedding for anything. And we loaded up and we got back over there. I don't know how we worked that. We hired a driver because we were still Amish. And you could hire a chauffeur and nobody would talk about it. We went back. And I remember, this is one of my earliest memories. I remember being at the reception of that wedding. And it was everything a three-year-old wanted, a three-year-old boy at least. There was tapioca pudding. And there was cake with gobs of frosting. And there were other little boys and girls having a grand time, and it was a merry occasion. I remember noise and laughter, and there were decorations on the cake, and they were kind of a little bit bigger than BBs. And they were just perfect for young folks, boys, to like wing out at each other. And these things were like ricocheting off the walls. And I remember walking around looking for those. And it's like, ah, got one. And I put those in my pocket. I was collecting them because they were kind of shiny and white, you know, with a little bit of a bluish tint to them. Ooh, I like those things. I just remember that was just a really good feeling of belonging and love and family there at that wedding. Well, things change. And not long after that, the Mennonites found us. Dean Hostetler, remember, came driving in his long black station wagon to sell my mom a Kirby vacuum cleaner. And of course, he was an amazing salesman. Because my mom, she said, we don't have a plug-in. We can't use vacuum cleaners. He said, he was not put off at all. He said, next Sunday, I'll come pick you up. You can come visit our church. And then you can have plug-ins. And you can buy a Kirby vacuum cleaner. I think it was a conflict of interest. Really, I do. But that's how it worked. And it was a Tricia Sindok. And I remember going. And I remember that, you know, there were reasons beyond electricity that my parents thought it was a good idea. Like my dad, who didn't like horses. He's like, tractors to drive and to farm with and go to heaven as well? I mean, what's not to like? Yeah. And the sermon, it had grace in it. And that just seemed like a wonderful idea. A little more grace, a little less works, you know? It's a little more about the feeling. We want to feel, and that's good. That's good. Yeah. So anyway, you know, that it all seemed like a really good idea at the time. And it didn't happen very quickly, but what we have to remember is there were people back home in Buchanan County, and they were really disturbed about that. And we worked through those things, and we had a lot of long conversations with grandparents and uncles and aunts. But, and you know, many of them could at least become somewhat accustomed to the idea. But Ida, Aunt Ida, took that really hard. It just seemed impossible. and unworkable. And then to make it even more tricky, Denny was in the lot. And wouldn't you know, he was ordained to be a deacon. And as we all know, deacons, they have to be really good examples, because how can you go, you know, and do the office of a deacon and demand perfection from your church and from all the parishioners if you yourself don't stand and be that good example? And so it was just a pretty difficult situation. You know, my parents were concerned about keeping relationships with family. And we'd go visit our aunts and uncles and our cousins twice a year, whether they liked it or not, because they were family. But we'd come, and you know, there were rules, and we all knew the rules. And one of them was, you know, if we ate a meal at a house with you know, relatives who were Amish, they were required, because they had streng Meidung then, they were required to sit, for us to sit at separate tables and have separate bowls of food. You know, well, all came from the same place, but it was symbolic, just to show that, show disapproval and concern. Well, that worked, you know, and we, you can get used to just about anything. We got used to that, and you know, we continued with the work of relationships and the work of caring for each other as an extended family. But it never really caught on so much at Denny and Ida's house. They didn't invite us to eat, even at a separate table. We never ate at their house. You know, we were invited to the wedding. We had that wonderful meal there. It just didn't happen. We'd show up once in a while, and they were not... They didn't tell us to leave. They were friendly, but they just didn't want to do that food thing. It was just too hard on them. And then, a few years into this, for various reasons, they decided to move. And they moved up into the north woods of Wisconsin, far away from everyone else, to a really conservative Amish church up there. And they proceeded to have children. I think they had 12 children. Just, you know, very focused. And those 12, you know, I have 90, 91 first cousins on the UTC side. And those 12 cousins were the ones I just barely even know. I can't say all their names because they kept themselves pretty far away from us. There was a circle letter with my aunts, and she didn't want to be part of that, you know, if my mom was part of it, because it was... You know, you have to really guard yourself carefully, is how she thought, I guess. But we'd hear of them occasionally. We heard that, you know, in years went by, we heard that that Denny had prostate cancer, and that it was caught, but not soon enough, really, and that he was okay. But, you know, his outlook kind of grim. And what else? We'd hear things, you know, that his cows, he milked cows. He was always a dairyman. His cow's got chronic wasting disease, and it's just awful if you're a dairyman. It's like your cows just kind of get skinny and don't give much milk, and one day, you know, you go out there, and one of them's on their back with their feet straight in the air, you know. It's the worst thing that can happen to a dairy farmer. And we'd, you know, occasionally write letters, and about the only time we ever saw Danny, Ida, and family was at funerals. Because funerals, you know, because God invites everyone, nobody has to feel obliged to, like, decide who sits where so much, right? And so we'd see each other at funerals once in a great while. And I try to, you know, visit, you know, because they were interesting. They were my relatives and stuff. But it's kind of hard, you know, from funeral to funeral to keep up very much with cousins. And so anyway... two summers ago, a cousin died. Harley Utsi, John's son Harley, died. He died after a long fight with cancer. And it was down to Mexico and back and being, you know, all kinds of, you know, it was a roller coaster for him and his family and his wife Frida and their 10 children, you know, from about 2 years all the way up to about 21. And when he died, you know, a lot of people had been praying for him and his family, and it was a huge funeral. And it happened, and it took place in Bloomfield, Iowa, where a number of the relatives live. And people came. All of the relatives came. I mean, just about all of the cousins were there, and the aunts and uncles. And we were more connected with that group of with John and his family, and I had told stories to the children on a number of occasions when we visited, but I was not prepared for right after we had the funeral and we buried Cousin Harley and all his stair-step family. They're all weeping, you know, and it was sad, and it was hard. And then we went back, and everybody ate. There were like 1,200 people there, and they all had food for everybody somehow. I don't know how they did that, but it was excellent. Then the 14-year-old, he came over to me and said, "Leroy, if I gathered all my brothers and sisters together, would you please tell the tailybone?" It was the deceased's own son. How can you, what do you do? It was a hard thing. And finally, I kind of gathered my wits and said, "Well, I will tell stories, but I can't tell the tailybone. It's not appropriate after a funeral." And he seemed okay with that, and he gathered his brothers and sisters, and they all came, you know, right out in the middle of the yard there, and they set up some benches, and they sat down, and they were ready to go. With, you know, 1,200 people all milling around doing, you know, power visiting and thinking about all the things that were going on. That's the way that Amish funerals work. It's an occasion when you visit and you make connections. So I proceeded to tell some stories that I thought were more appropriate for a funeral than was tailybone. And they seemed okay with it, and then I noticed that a bunch of people had stopped power visiting, and they started circling around. Layers, and I can actually talk and look at the same time, which is, you know, one of the few multitasking things I can do. I saw Aunt Ida off in the distance, and she was kind of moving in to see what the deal was. And I saw her, you know, really listening. And I kept track of her because, you know, that was one of my, you know, target audience, actually. And I don't remember if I changed stories or not, but I was watching. And then I noticed my mom had spotted her, too. And she was sidling up to her, unbeknownst to Ida, and got up pretty close. And then I saw them doing some, you know, like noticing each other and talking a little bit. And I found out afterwards that conversation. And it was more interesting than my stories. Aunt Ida looked at my mom, she looked her up and down, and she said, "Why are you wearing such a long dress?" If our mom would have made you wear a dress that long back when we were young, you would have had a fit. And my mom was also caught off guard. She was not expecting that kind of rebuke. Totally got her blindsided there. And all she could think to say was, I'm repenting of all my sins. And it got a little tiny hurt. The corners of her mouth turned up ever so slightly. Ever so slightly, yeah. And she'd been listening very intently. And then she turned to my mom and she said, "How did Leroy learn to tell stories like that?" And before my mom, what do you say to that? I mean, who knows? She spent her whole life telling me not to tell stories. Tell me the truth. And there I was, you know, and then she said, "I know, he learned that. He went to school to learn how to tell stories." She's a, you know, pretty wise woman, actually. And then after a while, you know, I was kind of winding down, she looked at my mom and said, if I invited all of my married children home, do you think Leroy would tell stories for us?" Yeah, I mean, people just, mouths kept dropping open and we didn't have anything to say is kind of how it was. But it turned out that my mom said, okay, yeah, let's do that. But remember the last time I wrote you a letter and said we're coming to visit and we showed up and nobody was home? You're not going to run away on us this time, are you? Yeah, we had to track her down. She'd gone all the way across the community to help one of the children with something or other. You know, we can tell when we're snubbed, can't we? So she agreed, she assured that that wouldn't happen. And a couple of summers ago, actually, there's one more thing I have to say. You know, I was somewhat privy to this before we left, and so I searched out Danny, Uncle Danny, Danny Gingrich, and I said, I heard a story about you, and I want to know if it's true or not. And I asked Danny, I said, I heard say that somebody came to your farm and offered you $15 million for your 200 acres. And I heard you said, no, I'm not selling, go away. And he hemmed a little bit and he said, well, it's almost that way. And he proceeded to give me a little lecture on oil wells. He said, you know how they're drilling these wells and they call it fracking. Yeah, I said, yeah. Well, it takes very special sand when you want to do fracking. Most sand, I didn't know this about sand, but Uncle Danny did. He said, most sand is like little pyramids. It's broken and it's sharp and pointy, like little tiny rectangles or pyramids. And when that sand packs together, it packs pretty tightly, and fluids can't flow through there very well. But there's a certain rare kind of sand, which they say was made by the glaciers, because the glaciers slowly rolled rocks down from Canada. And in the process of rolling rocks for hundreds of miles, they break up, and then they break into little sand things, and then the edges get rounded off until they're perfectly round. And he said, it just so happens the glacier stopped right at my farm. And there's this huge bed of this wonderful round sand, 35 feet under my farm. And somebody drilled a well really close to us, and when the sand came up from the well drilling, the well driller saw it was round sand. And he was just amazed, and he said, this is valuable. And I didn't do a thing, but pretty soon somebody came to my farm and said they wanted to drill a test well to see what kind of sand is really down there and how deep it is. And I said, sure, go ahead, the back 40. And they did. And they drilled down, and then pretty soon a guy came over, an agent came over, and he said, there's a lot of sand under your farm, and we would like to lease your farm. And we'll pay you $15 million for the privilege of taking your farm right off that sand and moving the sand out, and then we'll put your farm right back on it again, and then you can have it just the way you want it. And he said, Danny said, I told that man that I have to talk with my family about this because I'm old and I'm not going to live very much longer, so it's going to be their responsibility to spend all that money. And so Danny called in his brother, his siblings, his children, not his siblings, his children and their families, and they had a big family meeting. And they talked it over, and I asked, I was really interested, so what did you decide? And Danny said, well, what we decided is, that was a lot of money, $15 million. It was a lot of money. And if we had that much money, even if we divided it out 12 ways, we would have so much money we would never have to work again a day in our life. And we decided that would not be good for our spiritual life. And he said, the other thing, I've spent my whole life wishing for a farm. These are the things I wanted on my farm. I wanted trees, I wanted hills, and I wanted a stream. Because I like animals, I like wild animals. And he said, this farm is almost perfect that I have now up here in Augusta. It has hills, it has trees, it doesn't have a stream, but it has a nice big pond with frogs in it. And he said, I like my farm. I like the hills and the trees and the animals. And I don't want anybody to come and tear that all off and dig around under there and put it all back again. And it will be just a huge mess and a lot of noise and all those, you know, it just won't be right. And I'm too old. You know, I could go buy another farm, but that just wears me out thinking about that. No, just go away. I don't want your $15 million. I was just amazed. You know, I thought he was just kind of this narrow, hard-line deacon cracking the whip thing here. I mean, that was kind of almost wisdom. He was saying, I thought. So, I was impressed, and I said, you know, we're coming up to visit you, and I want to talk more about this. He said the man came back again, and when he told him, no, we're not interested, the man didn't know what to say for a little bit. He stuttered around, and then he said, well, would you take $19 million for it? He said, no. No, that's even worse. Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I would have done that, but that was Uncle Danny. Well, we came to visit on the appointed day. And we got there early, and Ida took us out on a walk, and we walked across the hills and through the trees, and we saw the place where they dug the test well, and I got some sand, and I was trying to see that it was round, and it's kind of hard to tell, but it was round, you know, and it was just a beautiful place. And then it was time to come in and eat. And we had, you know, there's different ways to do the two table things. You can have them spread tight together, and you almost don't even notice that, you know, it's two tables when you're eating and doing the shunning and banning and all that. Well, they wanted to be sure that it was clear, and so the tables were about a foot and a half apart. But the food was an absolute labor of love. It was Amish comfort food. We had mashed potatoes. We had chicken noodles and sausage. And we had tapioca pudding, and we had orange jello. It was all the things you brought out when you wanted to show people how much you appreciated them coming. And then for dessert, we had angel food cake, and we had canned strawberries, because it was wintertime. And as we were finishing our dessert, the children started coming in. Hordes of them. I mean, they all were doing the 10, 12 children each thing. And it was a good thing that we had a huge room in that house. I mean, big, you know, kind of kitchen, dining, living. And they were just filling it up there. And you know, these are all my cousins. I was looking at them and trying to figure out who they were and asking questions. And this was Jerry here. And he had fallen out of his tree stand when he was hunting deer. Ask how far up. Well, his stand is 40 feet up. He broke a bunch of ribs in his arm and cut himself with a broadhead, and it was pretty ugly, and he had to drag himself. I know what it feels like to have a broken rib. It is painful. Dragged himself somewhere, and finally they went looking for him and found him, and he'd healed up. And my Uncle Dave, his comment on that was he should come out to Montana to hunt deer, because out in Montana, the deer aren't up in the trees. It's just a lot easier to get them. They're down low. Yeah, we Utsis, we're smart that way. Well, some of them are. Yeah. Yeah. So there they were, and they lined up all around the edge of that huge room, sat themselves down, children running around, and I proceeded to tell stories. And they listened, and they laughed. Except there were several little boys. There was one little boy, he's about this tall, had the soup bowl haircut, and he was, I would say in Pennsylvania Dutch, degedrive. Completely, like, psycho kid almost. And the funny thing was, you know, he was this big, but obviously not yet potty trained, because he was wearing a poison green dress. And he was just, I had juggle balls, and he went for the juggle balls, and he clenched on those things, and I had to pry them out of his little fingers, you know. And it was obvious that the parents had kind of given up on him already. You know, he was a Gingrich. What can you do? You know, in the true, total, full sense of the word. And I ended up finally, I just hooked him around his middle and carried him here and talked with this hand and proceeded to tell the stories. And he thought it was kind of fun and just rode along for quite a while that way with his little dress out the back and everything. I mean, he was the kind of guy, he'd see another child, there was another little child there, and all of a sudden the other, it was just kind of a chubby child, less Gingrich maybe, and all of a sudden it was making gagging, choking noises, and we looked, and there was that little poison green dress boy, and he'd got her by the covering strings and was choking her to death. So we had to extract him because he was doing physical harm. I didn't quite realize what kind of cousins I had, you know. And it was I was well received, and we spent a lot of time catching up and hearing stories about each from each other and what's going on, and it was a time. It just made me think a little bit about, you know, what love really can be, and that there are actions that speak mountains of love to people. And that they can overcome feelings of separation and alienation really well. So that all seemed pretty successful. And you know, we visited. We ate 3 5-gallon buckets full of popcorn. Well, actually, there was fragments strewn around. They picked up. Not quite 12 baskets full, but a lot. It was a pretty amazing experience. And then people all left again, and there we were, Ida and Danny and my mom and dad and me, because that's all that was left at home. And then Danny wanted to tell me some stuff. And he told me this really interesting story. He took me over, and I thought this was just an ordinary china cupboard here. And he wanted to show me that he built that. And then he opened the doors right here, and he showed, and it was full of firewood. That was pretty interesting. Firewood in a china cupboard, underneath at least. And then I looked a little closer, and I saw, this is no ordinary firewood. And then he explained that he had made this, and he'd cut a hole out of the floor, and that there were little wheels underneath there, and there's this rope. Well, there's actually, it was a strap, like a load strap. And he had a crank in the basement and pulleys. And so he could lower that down into the basement, wheel it across the basement over where the wood pile was, where it came in, you know, far away, load it all nice, wheel it over here, and hook on and crank that up. And then when Aunt Ida needed a stick of wood for her wood stove, she could just open the door, get it out, and there was no mess or anything. It was just really slick, and it was kind of a Gingrich thing to do. And then he said, this was the fun part, he said, when I was designing this, something wasn't quite right. And the first time I loaded it up, and it cranked and cranked, and it went all the way up there, and it just wasn't going quite all, maybe like a stick of wood caught or something. And I just gave it a good another extra crank, and all of a sudden, the handle ripped out of that loaded wood box, and the whole thing came crashing down from the ceiling to the floor. Totaled the wood box, broke the wheels off. I had to start all over with that. However, he said, I realized I had a chance, and I was real quiet, and I lay down flat on my back right at the bottom of the stairs. And of course, Aunt Ida heard this terrific crash upstairs. And everything was quiet for a second, and then she said, Danny. He didn't say anything. I didn't say a thing. And then she said, Denny, where's the door at? And I didn't say anything. Just lay there. And then she came around and she looked down the stairs and she saw me lying there. And what did she say then? She said, Denny, when the door at, where's the door? And then I knew he'd pulled that stunt way too many times already before. The deacon, who would have thunk? Playing mean tricks on his wife like that. When we'd done our walk outside, this is another fun thing, Aunt Ida, we stopped at this maple tree, and it was about this big around, and she said, Danny planted that when we moved to this farm. It was in the edge of the yard. And when he found out he had prostate cancer and he thought he was going to die very soon, he went out and he drilled a hole in each side of that tree about this high. And then he bent a live branch around, cut the end off, stuck it tight in that hole here, and he bent another one around, stuck it tight in this hole here. And this had been a couple years now, and it had grown fast. It had grafted. And so there he had a living heart that he'd made in that tree. And he told his wife, he said, "Now, you know, when I die, you can come out here and look at this tree, and you can think about me." And Ida told us this, and he said, "He's a silly guy. Let's go look at the trees over here." So that was a fun little story there, too. And then I found out that the Gingriches had a reputation. The Gingriches did. And that back in Iowa, that's where Danny grew up, there were Gingriches kind of like there are Nisleys here. I mean, hordes of them. And they were there were like different family trees, so distant that they actually, Gingriches would marry other Gingriches, and nobody thought anything of it. Because they were like Abraham's seeds, and this was, you know, whoever else is over here. Well, that happened over there sometimes. And there were Gingriches, and people just knew that you had to watch your back when there was a Gingrich around. Because back in that time, people felt perfectly okay with playing practical jokes on each other. And practical jokes, I mean, just to give you an example, a practical joke would be Obi Gingrich. He was a deacon, right? But he also had a tile machine, and he'd make trenches in the mucky fields, and then they'd put tile down in there. It's hard work, and he would do that. He had a tile machine. And his nephew Eli would help him. Now, Eli was Danny's brother. And Danny and Eli's father were Ed Gingrich. Ed was the other deacon in the other district that had to come and get me into trouble when I was a little boy and didn't wear any clothes out on the street. That's a whole different story. But you have to think Obi, the deacon, you know, and they worked hard. They got up early, and right after the cows were milked, they went out, and Obi and Eli would work, and they'd string tile, and noon, they'd stop everything, turn it off, get in the shade, and eat their lunch. And then Obi was kind of like Alvin. He could sleep at the drop of a hat. A pin, not a hat. And he would eat his lunch, and he'd lie out flat, cross his arms like this, and he'd be sound asleep in less than a minute, and he would snore up a storm. And then in about 10 minutes, he'd wake up, and he'd be ready to go till chore time. Well, 10 minutes is a long time to leave Eli Gingrich with nothing to do. And one day, he realized that he had the makings of a practical joke with him. He had string in this pocket, and he got it out, and he carefully tied Obi's, the deacon's, hands together while he was sleeping. And then he undid his shoelaces and tied them together. And then he realized he had a firecracker over in this pocket and some matches to go with it. And he just put it a safe 6 or 8 inches from his right ear and lit it, and then he moved a safe 8 or 10 feet away. Just to see what would happen. Well, you know, it went bzz, boom! And Obi woke up before his time. It was only 8 minutes. And he was completely discombobulated. And he was tied up. And for a second, it was holy terror. You know, he'd read in the Martyr's Mirror, it was just awful. He thought, you know, at the end, and it was not nice. And then he figured out what was going on. And he survived, but he always had a memento. His ear had a ringing sound in it. But he, you know, as soon as he got his wits collected, he laughed it off, because if you got mad, then they got you. And that was like losing the whole game thing here. And all I can say is, you know, they were less brittle and had more humor back then than now, because I think that would be considered almost criminal to do now. And you'd have to have a lawsuit and who knows what else, and an ear transplant and stuff. So that gives you an idea of what Gingriches would do. I've got one more here, and we have to learn a word for this one. And it's Gottsdossig. And that's a Pennsylvania Dutch word that is used specially only in Buchanan County, Iowa, and literally means 1,000 barks. And it's kind of like if somebody does something really dumb and harmful, you might say, Gatsdasik. And that would mean 1,000 barks on you. You know, may the dog bark all night and keep you from sleeping, that kind of thing. It's kind of like, you know, there's a song about an elephant caressing you with his toes or, you know, that kind of thing. So it's a gentle showing of disapproval. So Obi was at home, and his wife, she said, we need groceries. You take the hack buggy and you go down to Fairbank, to the IGA, and you get this list, had a whole list. And he said, fine, sure. Hitched up the horse, away he went. And while he was there with his list and his shopping cart, loading it up, Eli came around the corner. And Eli's like, well, Obi, good to see you. And chatted a while, and they just happened to be in the section with the beverages. And while they were talking, you know, and Obi wasn't paying attention, Eli just picked up a box of beer and put it in Obi's cart as a practical joke. Well, and after a while, he said, time to go, and he headed off, and Obi filled up with the rest of the stuff, drove up to the checkout, they put it all in boxes, and he paid. He wasn't paying attention. He was a guy. And put it in the back of the buggy, of the open buggy, and halfway home, his 4 miles, he got the munchies. And he remembered that he'd bought a block of cheese, and he reached back and was like rooting around for that block of cheese, and he came up with a block. And he looked at it, and he's like, beer. That wasn't on the list. And then he realized what had happened. He said, Gatsdasik, Sala alt ile. And because he was the deacon, he had to turn that buggy around and go back to the IGA and return the box of beer. But then the next time he saw Eli, Eli was watching because he was going to see, is the deacon going to be mad? And Obi was smart. He came up and he said, oh, Eli, you must be one of my old drinking buddies. Because he would have never heard the end of it if he'd have gotten mad. Yeah, it's the way it is. We got to talk about one more Gingrich, and then we're done, okay? And this one's Rudy. Rudy was a distant relative. It was like on the other side of the Nisleys, I mean the Gingriches. And he was a mechanic, and that's partly why I like him. And he's still alive. He lives in Buchanan County, and he's close to 90, I think. But when he was young, he had a shop, and he repaired motors. And people used to come there. It was the hub. People would show up there, and they would gossip and sit and visit with Rudy. And it was just a fun place to be, especially in the winter, because he had a nice pot-bellied stove there, and he'd be working on little engines and stuff. And they'd come, and he would be there all day working on engines, and he would be thinking Gingrich thoughts, which were, how could I play a practical joke on people who come to see me? And one day he realized the perfect solution for that, he had an old wooden chair, and people liked to sit on that and visit. And so he wired that chair up. He put 2 16-penny nails, one in each cheek area, and then he ran some little wires inauspiciously over and around and to his workbench, and he had a Model T Ford coil, and he had a 6-volt battery. And he had it all rigged up. It looked just like normal stuff that you'd have strewn on your workbench. Nobody was suspicious. And people would come in, you know, one at a time. He'd get them one at a time. It was better that way. Sit on that chair and proceed to tell them about the weather and what they'd heard over in the other district after church. And just when they were totally relaxed and fully becoming one with the chair, he would push the little button over here and it would go... And people would literally levitate. It was almost a miracle. And they would be like, oh, you know, where did that come from? And how did I deserve that? But then they'd remember and they'd laugh it off. And then they would stand and they would hope somebody else would come in. So they could be privy to the next sucker. And that's the way it worked, one after the other, until everybody, all the regulars, got shocked. And finally, nobody would sit in that chair anymore. And so he had to rearrange things because they all started sitting over here on the bottom step that went up to the upstairs. And it was just a, it was a 2x8. And you could drive 16 penny nails in that too and add some wires. And then you'd have another button. And everybody got shocked there too. And finally, they wouldn't sit down. They just carefully, gingerly, you know, not touch a thing. Then he had to take a condenser, just a little condenser out of a little Briggs and Stratton, and if he saw somebody coming, he would charge it up on a little motor. He'd have the motor running, nobody was suspicious, and they'd open the door and he'd say, "Here, catch," and throw it right at their face, and they'd catch it, and it would shock the bejabbers out of their fingers. But people did not learn their lesson, they just kept coming in. Well, that kind of died down, and he was kind of thinking about a new trick, and one day, Pinky came in. Pinky was a driver, and he'd driven Amish for a long time in a long van, and he'd eaten a lot of hearty Amish meals with tapioca and all that stuff, and it showed. And he had till 4 o'clock, you know, 3 hours to kill till he had to go back, pick up his people to go on. And he drove along and he saw a sign, you know, motors repaired. And he thought, well, it looks like there's a stove in there. I'll go sit in there and wait for 3 hours. He walked in and howdy, and he sat on that nice wooden chair. And, you know, his self kind of hung down over the sides a little. He probably weighed 400 pounds. And visited, you know, just the way you would. And Rudy, yeah, he visited a while, and then he had this conscience attack. He was like, would you shock an Englishman or not? Like, you know, there's no question with Amish. You shock them. But would you shock an English? And he thought about it a while, you know, and it was kind of back and forth, and finally, he was a Gingrich, you know, the dark side took over, and he, you know, thoroughly hit the button because he was big. He figured it'd take more electricity. And he said it was truly a miracle because Pinky had probably not jumped, you know, in probably 25 years. And he came up, he levitated, he rose off that chair. I mean a couple feet. And he hung in midair for a while. And then slowly the miracle subsided. And he came back down gathering speed. And when he hit the chair again, it parted just like Moses. Moses in the Red Sea. And that chair went into firewood. And that was the end of Rudy's electric chair. Yeah. And certainly not the end of his escapades. I want to go visit Rudy, and I want to hear some stories from him before he dies. His son is married to one of my... No, his grandson's married to one of my cousins, so I'd have an excuse. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed hearing a little bit about some of the stress and strain that our family has gone through. And I want you to remember, from Brené Brown, The Gifts of Imperfection, that love is uncertain, it's not easily measured, and sometimes it shocks. And I also want you to remember that love is about belonging and about family, and that there is nothing more important than that. All the money in the world is not as good as belonging to a family and to a community and feeling a part of something bigger than ourselves. And finally, I want you to think about love as being an action, not just a feeling. Because feelings come and feelings go. But we are human beings. We have four brains. We can think about ourselves and we can think about the results of our actions. And we can create an environment of love if we want to. And it is work. I'm not saying this is easy or that it's a shortcut, but we can do that, and it is worth it. Thank you for your attention.